Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Complementary and Alternative Medicine and MS. Your host, Sue Farnsworth, will now begin.
Thank you all so much for registering for our teleconference this evening. We're also pleased that you could be on the line with us. I'm Sue Farnsworth, your moderator from the National MS Society. And this teleconference has been funded by Novartis and is one of many helpful programs and services available to people living with MS through the National MS Society. From support groups to care management, financial assistance to political advocacy, we're here to help and partner with you. Whether you're a person living with MS, a friend or caregiver, the National MS Society is here to connect you with the information and resources you need. Contact us by calling 1-800-344-4867. Before we get started on our main presentation, we'd like to share a little bit of our chapter information to get you excited about one of our upcoming events by introducing Iram Ahmed, team captain for the team Hot Steppers at Walk MS in Irvine, California. Iram and her team of over 20 members raised over $6,500 at last year's Walk. Iram was diagnosed with MS at age 22 in 2006. Go ahead, Iram.
Okay. Hi, everyone. As the introduction stated, my name is Iram Ahmed, and I'm captain of the team Hot Steppers. When I was asked to give a speech about my experience with the MS Walk, it couldn't have come at a more perfect time. I am currently working on fundraising and recruiting members for Walk MS 2013. I actually look forward to this event every single year for many reasons. First, I love that I'm able to build a team with family, friends, classmates, and coworkers. It is absolutely amazing to see everyone come out to support you and to show their love for you and for the cause. The big picture, of course, is to help find a cure for MS, but that goal cannot be reached alone. We need to work together as a team and as a community. The MS Walk provides a great resource and starting point for helping us reach this goal. Second, I love that the MS Walk gives me the courage to share my story and experience on living with multiple sclerosis. I believe that awareness of the cause is very important. For me personally, it helps me feel like I'm not going through this alone. Awareness also helps others understand the difficulties that MS brings into our daily lives, not just as individuals, but also how it affects our families and loved ones too. By bringing about awareness, we can make others understand the importance of raising money for research. The MS Walk websites are 100% accessible all the time, which makes fundraising and managing your team simple and convenient. And third, I love the energy that the MS Walk brings to each and everyone who attends. It is always so refreshing to be with loved ones, to meet new people, to watch kids running around getting their faces painted, to see people bring their dogs out for a nice, peaceful stroll, to hear the music from the live band that's playing on stage, and to even going around consuming all the free food that you can eat. To be living with such a debilitating disease is hard enough as it is, but the National Multiple Sclerosis Society really knows how to lift everyone's spirits and makes fundraising and causing awareness such a joy. So thank you, everyone, for listening, and I hope you find the same joy that I do with being a part of the MS Walk.
Thank you, Iram, for all that you're doing.
Tonight's teleconference
will discuss complementary and alternative medicine, CAM, and MS. Our featured speaker this evening is Dr. Alan Bowling. Dr. Bowling is an internationally recognized physician for his work in CAM. He is the director of the Complementary and Alternative Medicine Program and the Multiple Sclerosis Service at the Colorado Neurological Institute. He is also the clinical associate professor of neurology at the University of Colorado. Dr. Bowling has more than 100 lay and professional publications and is the author or co-author of 4 books, including Complementary and Alternative Medicine and Multiple Sclerosis. He has provided consultation or authored publications on CAM for many neurological organizations around the world, including the National MS Society, Multiple Sclerosis International Federation, and the American Academy of Neurology. Following this teleconference, you will receive an email containing additional information about this evening's topic, as well as other programs and services available to you through the National MS Society. I thank you again for being on the call this evening, and at this time, I'd like to hand it off to Dr. Bowling. Dr. Bowling?
Well, great. Thanks for the nice introduction and pleasure to be doing the program tonight. I want to thank National MS Society for inviting me to do this program. I've had a nice partnership with National MS Society for many years and have partnered in multiple ways, but one has been in the area of complementary and alternative medicine. There's a lot of information that we've put out collaboratively over the years, and actually I will refer to some of that at the end of the program. So just to start out here, I think many people with MS have an interest in this topic. Most people with MS use some type of unconventional medicine, but it's often hard to find objective information. So that's the aim of the program tonight. And what I'm going to do is sort of divide this into a few different parts. We'll start off with some general precautions, just some concepts to be aware of when you're considering unconventional therapies. And then I'm going to go through a listing of therapies that are, some are popular, some are less popular, and I'm going to kind of divide them into three categories. One are therapies that might be worth considering, another is sort of a gray zone area, and then the third area are therapies that I would be very cautious about, or I would avoid using them. So to get started here, the very first sort of precaution I want to give is that with the program tonight, I'm not giving specific medical recommendations, so you really need to talk with your own healthcare provider about this information. General guidelines with unconventional therapies, I would watch for what I call telltale signs. That's a strong reliance on testimonials. If there's some dietary supplement that has ingredients that are claimed to be secret, I'd be cautious there. And if there are claims that seem excessive, like one treatment can help 100 different diseases, I'd be cautious about that. Another area that applies especially to MS is to be careful if something works in a test tube or the animal model of MS. That doesn't necessarily mean it's going to work in people with MS. And then a lot of the program tonight, I'm going to talk about dietary approaches, diets and dietary supplements. That's going to be one of the main areas of focus. With any kind of dietary approach, it's important to not use those to the exclusion of medications that have definitively been shown to be effective. And then just a general thought with regard to diet, and I must say I think of this every day, at least once a day, often more than once a day, but there's lots of information out there about dietary approaches. You know, many, many books have been written on the topic. And I still like this quotation from Michael Pollan, who's written many books on nutrition. And he was nice enough to summarize his thousands of pages of writing recently in seven words. And I think of this often. So the seven words are eat food. So don't rely on highly processed foods and don't rely on dietary supplements. So it's eat food, not too much, and mostly plants. So those seven words, like I say, those go through my head at least once a day, usually at lunch when I'm trying to make a decision about what to eat in our the hospital lounge area. So why don't we go on and we'll talk about, like I said, the first part, we're going to talk about some areas that I think are worth considering, and one that's very popular, kind of rose into popularity several years ago is vitamin D, and I think many people have now heard of this, but it's surprising that 3 to 4 years ago this was a not such a common topic. So it's at least half the U.S. population is thought to be deficient or insufficient in vitamin D, and there's probably multiple causes, avoiding the sun, using sunscreen, also obesity, that puts someone at a higher risk for being low in their vitamin D levels, also taking in less fortified foods, especially in children, so lower intake of dairy products especially can lead to low vitamin D levels. In terms of definite cause-effect, where low vitamin D causes a medical condition. The only area we have absolutely definitive evidence is with the bone health. So low vitamin D definitely produces bone thinning, known as osteoporosis, or the milder version, osteopenia. What's been shown more recently are associations of low vitamin D with many other medical conditions. The list is now more than 20 other medical conditions have been associated with a low vitamin D. And some of the most notable studies in this area are actually in MS, where low vitamin D has been associated with a higher risk for the disease, higher risk for attacks, possibly a higher risk for progression of disability. So many different studies showing this association of low vitamin D with various aspects of MS. The missing piece of information, though, is a definite causal connection. In other words, a definite definite studies showing that low vitamin D causes MS, or that low vitamin D can actually increase the risk for attacks. The studies to date really are primarily associations, where you just take a population of people with MS and the general population, and then you find people with MS having lower vitamin D levels. That doesn't prove that the low vitamin D caused the disease. So what's needed, and there are studies underway, is in terms of determining if vitamin D can help people with MS with regard to their symptoms or attacks, is to take people with MS and give half of them a placebo, give half of them vitamin D, and then track over time. So those are known as intervention studies. There are smaller studies that have been done at this point. I'm aware of six of those. And of the six intervention studies, three indicate that there is a causal connection. Three do not show a causal connection. So it's a growing area of research, and we'll have to watch the studies over time, and then also over time the studies get larger and we can get some more definitive results in that area. And an area to be very thoughtful about is how much to take, and this can be determined by using a blood level, and blood levels of vitamin D are readily available. There's normal ranges for the vitamin D levels, and there's been concern recently that we don't want to be too low with the vitamin D because of all the health risks that could be associated with that. But then there's some indication, it's not definitive, but some suggestion that if vitamin D gets too high, then it might actually increase the risk of some conditions, including some cancers, heart disease, bone fractures, falls. So it's almost like there's a happy mid-zone with vitamin D, and that's led some people to call this the Goldilocks effect, and that's been observed with some other dietary supplements. And the idea is kind of going back to the story of Goldilocks, where she finds the porridge, and one is too hot, one is too cold, and then there's one just in the middle. So that's areas of study, lots of different areas, economics, some other academic areas talk about this Goldilocks effect, and now that's being potentially applied to vitamin D. So the happy mid-zone might be blood levels between 35 and 50, but this is the specific details here you definitely need to talk with your healthcare provider about. Also, something that I find often is missing in vitamin D assessment of people with MS is if the blood level is quite low, you can correct it by giving vitamin D, and you can do blood levels in the future to make sure the blood level has come up. But what's often not done is to then check the bone density. If the vitamin D level is low, then someone could have osteoporosis, and it'd be important to recognize that at that time as opposed to sometime in the future when a serious bone fracture occurs. The next area I want to touch on briefly are polyunsaturated fatty acids. This area has a long history in MS, goes back to the days of Dr. Roy Swank. Some of you who've been in the MS world for a long time know his name well. He wrote the MS Diet book. He did studies back in the 1940s associating higher intake of polyunsaturated fatty acids, especially omega-3 fatty acids like are found in fish. He associated higher intake of that type of oil with a lower risk for developing MS. So over the years, there have been scientific studies, studies in the animal model of MS, some studies of variable quality in people with MS, and many of these studies have indicated that having a diet low in saturated fat and higher in these polyunsaturated fats may well be helpful, but the studies have not certainly not been definitive, but there's been a suggestion in some of these studies. The follow-up to all of this, which is why I'm bringing this up tonight, is there recently was a Norwegian study. It's quite a high-quality study. It wasn't perfect, but quite a high-quality study just reported last year where they had 92 patients with MS, and they treated for 6 months just with fish oil or placebo, and then after 6 months they added on an interferon to both groups. I'm not going to go through all the details of the study, but it was quite a sophisticated study. They looked at all kinds of MRI measures. They looked at people's how often people were having attacks, looked at disability levels, and there was no statistically significant benefit seen with that treatment. And so that really goes against what the suggested suggestive findings have been in multiple studies in the past. So I don't think this study is the absolute final piece of information on it. The study was not large enough to see smaller effects. It was relatively short. People just took fish oil capsules. They didn't also change their diet. So there are clearly limitations to this, but it is kind of a humbling result and needs to be taken into context with past studies. Once again, that's something to talk through with your healthcare provider, how to interpret that for your situation. Another area that I'd like to touch on briefly is vitamin B12 deficiency. It's been known for a few decades that there is a subgroup of people with MS who are at risk for vitamin B12 deficiency. Vitamin B12 deficiency can mimic MS. It can produce fatigue, cognitive difficulties, numbness, walking problems, weakness. So I think it's quite important for people with MS at least at one time point to be checked for their vitamin B12 level. And if the level is low, you can typically just treat with supplements, or if it's really low, treat with injections. And also, sort of a corollary to all this, if the vitamin B12 level is normal, then there's actually there's not any clear benefit to taking vitamin B12. And then another dietary approach that I think is quite underutilized in people with MS is fiber. And many of you probably know that MS makes you at risk for constipation, and that may be due to decreased nerve input to the intestines, so there's just not as much intestinal activity, and then that can lead to constipation. Combined with that, I think what often happens is people with MS and also just the average American has a relatively low fiber intake, which puts them at risk for constipation as well. So it's sort of a double hit to the intestine. It's not getting enough fiber, plus the MS can limit the intestinal activity. So the average U.S. intake of fiber is about 50% of what's recommended. So this is quite a simple way to potentially address constipation issues. It's not drug-based, and the treatment for it can have other health benefits. So high-fiber foods include fruits, vegetables, beans, grains, nuts, seeds. So I think that's an area that's often not thought about. And then the final sort of area that I think is quite worthy of consideration are unconventional forms of exercise. I think Tai Chi and yoga people are now quite familiar with. Those have become quite popular, especially yoga. There is a well-designed study of yoga in MS showing improvement in fatigue. Anecdotal reports, people with yoga describing less muscle stiffness and less pain. actually are two smaller studies of Tai Chi showing improvement in walking steadiness and muscle stiffness. And then another unconventional physical activity approach is Pilates, and this is growing in popularity. And I bring it up just because we're seeing more people use it in our clinic, and we've actually seen some benefits with regard to MS-related issues. So Pilates was developed by Joseph Pilates back in World War I. He had an interesting job description. He was a boxer, but he was also a dancer and an inventor. So he seemed like he would have been quite the character to meet. He actually developed the exercise program, this Pilates program, to rehabilitate soldiers, and then over time it actually became a popular approach for dancers. And a real focus with Pilates are the core muscles, which I think at least many of us Americans have not a real high awareness of what the core muscles are and how to even use or exercise the core muscles. So we've found this approach very helpful in many of our patients with MS who have weakness of the core muscles, but also especially weakness of the hip flexors. And if you're sitting down now, you may already know if you have weakness in those muscles, but if you're sitting, you can just put your hand on your knee and try to lift up your knee and see if you can exert a lot of strength there. If you can't, if there's some pushing down that you can do with your hand, then you may well have hip flexor weakness, and Pilates and other core exercises can be quite helpful. So now I want to cover two areas that are in kind of a gray zone where we just don't have enough information, but I think they're quite popular, and I would like to let you know what we know about these within the context of MS. So one is gluten sensitivity. In many parts of the United States, this has gotten to be very popular. In terms of being sensitive to gluten, and that's a protein in wheat and some other grain products, there's definitive sensitivity to gluten that can lead to a very clear condition known as celiac disease. That affects about 1% of the population. And people have GI symptoms like bloating and abdominal discomfort when they take in gluten. There's very specific blood tests that can be done, and this can be treated with a gluten-free diet. It can be associated with vitamin D deficiency, iron deficiency. There are a lot of other associated conditions with celiac disease, so that's a very important disease to definitively diagnose and to treat with a gluten-free diet. A less clear area is what much of the interest in gluten has been over the past several years, and that's known as gluten sensitivity. Some people call it celiac light, L-I-T-E, as if it's a light version of celiac disease. While celiac disease affects 1% of the population, some estimates say this gluten sensitivity might be very common, like 10 to 25% of the population. This is a difficult condition to get a handle on. It's been very difficult to study because there are no specific diagnostic criteria for it. There's no blood test for it. There aren't even necessarily stomach symptoms or intestinal symptoms that come up with this. It's really characterized by producing some symptom that can be fatigue or in people with MS, tingling or worsening of other MS-type symptoms when someone takes in food that has gluten in it. So in this area, there really are very few formal studies. It's, like I said, it's hard to study because there are no clear diagnostic criteria, so it's hard to know who has this. It's really sort of a subjective assessment whether you have this, and the way to investigate on your own is to eliminate gluten from the diet and then see if you feel improved in some way. In MS, there are no studies that have been done with this. And at this point, it really is not clear. It could be that there is some type of gluten sensitivity that's different than celiac disease, and it does produce all these effects that I have just described. But at the same time, there could also be, in addition to that, something that's not a true intestinal condition. And there's concern that some of this may not be a real disease process, and it might be some idea people have in their head that gluten is bad, so then if they take it in, they feel bad. And that's well documented. It's kind of the opposite of a placebo response. A placebo, you think something's going to make you feel better, and it does. The reverse is a nocebo, where if you think something is bad, then it can make you feel bad. So this area really needs some high-quality studies, and the first step is to try to come up with some diagnostic criteria to figure out who has the condition, and then you can actually do formal studies. In the meantime, it's a fairly benign experiment on your own to decrease or eliminate gluten from the diet and then track the symptoms that you have. Only concerns there are that if you truly have celiac disease, then doing that approach on your own without formal monitoring might lead to a delay in the diagnosis and inappropriate treatment for celiac disease, which, like I say, can have some other associated conditions that can be serious. It also can be laborious and expensive to try to take gluten out of your diet, although that has gotten easier more recently. Another area that I put kind of in a gray zone is the Paleolithic diet. This has also grown in popularity over the last several years. And this, I think many people have heard of this, but they don't quite know what it is or where it came from. It actually was first proposed back in the 1970s, and the idea was that we have the genetic makeup of our caveman ancestors, but we have a very different lifestyle. We have very different activity levels and very different food intake than our caveman ancestors. So the idea is that maybe a disconnect between our genetic makeup and what we should eat, what we should be eating, may contribute to many diseases of modern civilization. So that's sort of the base concept where this came from. And over the years, there have been some studies to support that this Paleolithic diet might be helpful for some medical conditions, more in the sort of cardiovascular disease, diabetes area, but it has undergone no specific study in MS. The features of the diet are, some of them are just sort of general healthy diet approaches. Others are a little different, but might be reasonable for someone with MS to pursue. So it's basically lower levels of refined carbohydrates, lower levels of sodium, and then there are higher levels of fiber. And I already just talked about how I think fiber is under-consumed in people with MS and in the general population in the U.S. And then there's also higher levels of protein in the Paleolithic diet. It's quite clear in the Paleolithic diet that this should be lean meat. So if it's red meat, you know, very lean red meat. If you push too high with protein in the form of fatty red meat, that can lead to quite high saturated fat intake, which goes against what I talked about earlier, where with Dr. Swank and other approaches, the general strategy is to lower the saturated fat and increase the polyunsaturated fat. So like I mentioned, there's no formal study of the Paleolithic diet in MS. If you're considering doing this, I would talk to your healthcare provider about it. And I guess the one caveat would be about the red meat aspect of it, and that you really need to be careful about not highly increasing the saturated fat intake. And now in terms of supplements of concern or approaches of concern. There are some books on alternative medicine in the section on MS. They say MS is an immune disease, therefore you should be activating your immune system with various supplements, and then these supplements are listed. Many of you probably recognize that's the opposite of what you should be doing. So just precautionary information about some supplements that could activate the disease or block the effects of MS medication. So I think the one that's best known is echinacea. There's also an Ayurvedic herb known as ashwagandha. So that's used in Ayurveda, but it's also in some other dietary supplements. So both the echinacea and ashwagandha, multiple scientific studies show that those the supplements can activate immune cells known as T cells, which are already too active in MS. They may also activate macrophages, which are a particular type of immune cell as well. And then another area that I think is sometimes under-recognized that raises concern are some of the herbs used in traditional Chinese medicine. Now, traditional Chinese medicine is a multimodal healing approach. It includes acupuncture. Tai Chi can be a component of that. And then herbs are often a component of it. And in terms of acupuncture itself, often acupuncture is done, and then at the end of the session, a bag of herbs might be provided to use until the next acupuncture session. So I won't go into detail about acupuncture, but I think of that as quite a low risk and potentially helpful therapy for some symptoms. But the herbs I put in a very different category, where there's actually there isn't any known benefit of those herbs in MS, and in fact, some of the herbs used in traditional Chinese medicine can actually may activate the immune system. Two other supplements to be cautious about that I'm seeing more of in the last 1 to 2 years in our clinic. One is the vitamin B6 or pyridoxine. So this is kind of a classic example of that Goldilocks effect that I mentioned earlier. The vitamin B6 or pyridoxine, you need a certain amount of that for the nerves to be healthy and function normally. So if vitamin B6 gets too low, that causes nerve injury. But it's very definitive. If you take in too much vitamin B6, then that can cause a nerve injury. So it's same thing as the vitamin D. So you, with vitamin B6, there's sort of a happy medium. And for many years, I think through the 1990s into the 2000s, nearly all dietary supplements that I saw that contained vitamin B6 had reasonable doses, which we generally think of as doses up to 50 milligrams, 50 milligrams. But I've seen just in the past couple of years, people coming in with their supplements, and they often will contain 100 milligrams or 150 or 200 milligrams, and that's definitely in the range where you can have nerve injury. And it's never been looked at, but if the nerves are being threatened by a disease process like MS, and then you add in something that can potentially be toxic to the nerves, that might be especially difficult for the nerves to, that might produce a situation where it's especially hard for the nerves to function. Another supplement that I'm seeing more of, and I think sometimes it's marketed specifically to MS, is germanium, and that's actually an element, sort of that high school chemistry class, the periodic chart of the elements. So germanium is one of those elements. There's actually no study showing it helps MS. There's no scientific reason why it would help MS, and there also are multiple cases of people with kidney or liver toxicity due to that element, germanium. So I would definitely avoid that. So those are the areas that I wanted to highlight tonight. I hope the information about each therapy has been helpful, and also the guidelines that I gave at the beginning. I did want to highlight, and I mentioned at the beginning, that I've worked collaboratively with National MS Society, so I've written various pamphlets. There's a pamphlet on vitamins, minerals, and herbs. I've also written various articles. I write professional publications with National MS Society, so you certainly, I think you can access that information through the nationalmssociety.org website. And then I have a website where I have it's free information. There's no registration, no fees. It really is just free information that's out there for people with MS, and it's on many different unconventional therapies, and that's at neurologycare.net and then /CAM. So you can go there, and it's a sort of alphabetical indexed listing of different unconventional therapies. And then there are various books that I've written as well that you can, I'm sure you can find access to those. So I'd like to once again thank the National MS Society for inviting me to be part of this program, and then also the opportunity to work with them over the years. I'm also based, like you heard, at the Colorado Neurological Institute, so they've provided a lot of support for developing information like I've shared with you tonight. And then I can't take a long time and to talk about it tonight, but there are a lot of individuals and other organizations that have provided the support to our program over the years. So I think I'll stop there, and we can open it up for questions.
Okay, I think our operator, Dawn, is going to be coordinating some of that.
Yes, ma'am.
Dawn, okay.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Again, if you'd like to ask a question, please press the number 1 key on your phone. Please hold while calls or questions come into queue. Okay. First question is from Diana. Diana, please go ahead.
I would like the website repeated, and I also had a question about the use of, what are they called, probiotics and CoQ10 and curcumin, if any of those have value.
The website, the two websites I mentioned, the National MS Society, that's nationalmssociety.org, and then the other is neurologycare.net, and then there's a / then CAM, like complementary and alternative medicine.
Just to jump in, everyone who's on the line will be getting a follow-up email with these addresses tomorrow, so if you're concerned about that.
And then I think those two websites then will open up a whole world to you of many other places you can go for information. In terms of probiotics, yeah, surprisingly, there hasn't been a study of that in MS. I think there's some early studies being done in the animal model of MS that show that there might be some modulation of the immune system that might actually be beneficial, but there are no formal studies in that area. Coenzyme Q10, that's a really interesting compound for MS and other neurological conditions because with MS and other neurological conditions, there might be free radical injury, and that could damage the nerve cells, and coenzyme Q10 can sort of fight off the free radical. Free radicals, it's an antioxidant. It also feeds into the energy-making pathways in nerve cells, so nerve cells that are having a hard time energetically may benefit by coenzyme Q10 being around. But at this point, there are no studies I'm aware of. There are none that have been reported with MS, with antioxidants generally. There are some that, like vitamin E, vitamin C, that might actually have an activating effect on the immune system. So that has raised some, at least theoretical, concerns about pushing antioxidants real high in people who have immune conditions like MS. I must say, the limited studies we have in people with MS with other antioxidants have not shown any worsening of the disease by giving the antioxidants. And then curcumin, yeah, I think that's gone. There's some theoretical reasons how it could help MS and some other neurologic conditions, but I think more of the formal research clinical studies are more in the neurodegenerative, the aging-related neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's disease.
Our next question comes from Tammy. Tammy, please go ahead.
Is there any benefit to, have there been any studies for Protandim and MS?
Yes, Protandim, so that's, I was just talking about coenzyme Q10 and, you know, antioxidant and energy repleting effects of coenzyme Q10, and Protandim has been developed to try to help with so the free radical energy aspects of cells, nerve cells, and other cells in the body that might be having a difficult time functioning. But there, at least with MS, there are no clinical trials that have been reported with that. It would be nice to have a formal study of that in MS because it does have some very interesting qualities. That is a supplement that has that Ayurvedic herb ashwagandha in it. And like I said, ashwagandha very clearly activates immune cells known as T cells. And in MS, the T cells are too active. We really want to be decreasing the activity of those. So based on the scientific information, which is all we have, that's not something I would put at the top of the list for people with MS.
Our next question comes from Lee. Lee, please go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much for your time this evening. We've talked a lot about supplements and everything in regards to they had suggestive or weren't very beneficial during their studies or anything. Is there any supplements out there that show benefits for MS in their current studies, whether longitudinal or not?
Yeah, the ones that I think have the most promise and have indicated some beneficial effects are the ones that I started the program with. So I would, my top three to be considered by people with MS, I think, are vitamin D. And like I said, there's many studies with a very suggestive effect there. But you know, to do an interventional study, that's that costs lots of money, and it's those are very detailed studies, but they're actually in the process of being done. So I think over the next year or two, we'll get a better sense. But in the meantime, that's certainly an area that if you talk with your healthcare provider, you can get vitamin D levels, and you can be supplemented if you are on the low side. So I'd put that at the top of the list. Fish oil used to be at the top of my list, but this more recent study has moved it down, but I don't think it's totally off the list. And then vitamin B12, I think that tends to be not checked regularly, at least in my area, in people with MS. And at least in my area, that seems to be more common to find lower levels of that. So at least in my part of the country, people with MS are getting that checked less frequently, but we're seeing low levels more often. So those would be kind of three at the top of the list. And then others, just to add, would be cranberry for a lot of people with MS are prone to urinary tract infections. So there's some multiple studies indicating that cranberry can help prevent urinary tract infection, not treat them, but help prevent them. And then fiber, as I talked about.
Our next question comes from Mike. Mike, please go ahead.
Yeah. Is the B12 in a pill form okay? Because I keep hearing that it's only you need to take it in a shot form from the doctor. And also, I think I eat like collard greens. If I just eat some collard greens and kale, wouldn't I get enough B12?
Right. So if your vitamin B12 is not dangerously low, then the more recent approach in the U.S., I guess in the past 5 years or so, has been to just give people supplements of vitamin B12. If it's real low and you have neurological symptoms from it, then you probably should be treated with injections to just get the level up as soon as possible. But that's pretty rare to have kind of critically low vitamin B12 levels. There are some people who just can't absorb vitamin B12 from the GI tract. So if you do whatever approach you use, but especially if you take the oral vitamin B12, it's very important 3 to 6 months later to recheck the vitamin B12 to make sure that you've that you're actually absorbing it and the blood levels are going up. And the vitamin B12, that is an area where you could increase your intake of B12-enriched foods. But at the same time, it's if you truly have a low level, you don't want to mess around initially. You really want to get the blood level up. Once the blood level's up, if you wanted to then have documentation the level's up, then maybe the supplementation could be cut back and try to change the diet, but then would need to follow the B12 levels to make sure they're not drifting down again.
Mark should be listening to this. It's very good.
Our next question comes from Margaret. Margaret, please go ahead.
My question was just to repeat the website. So someone's already done that and also going to get an email, so I appreciate that. Thank you.
Our next question comes from Robert. Robert, please go ahead.
Yes. There were supposedly some studies in England about the use of cannabis for MS, and I was wondering if anything ever came out of those.
I think in the whole world, I think the United Kingdom really has led the way in terms of doing high-quality studies of marijuana and MS. So they actually commissioned a group 10 or 12 years ago to look at all the evidence, what was available about marijuana and different medical conditions. They thought the evidence for MS looked promising, not definitive, but promising. So they actually put a certain percent of the research budget of the country into marijuana and MS studies. So that led to a study reported several years ago where there was an indication that a marijuana extract may have some beneficial effects on muscle stiffness or spasticity. And then that led to a larger study, and that's probably the one you're referring to. So it's the CUPID study, just like it sounds, C-U-P-I-D, which I thought it's a very cute name for a marijuana-based study, but totally rigorous, you know, world-class study, and it's using cannabis to try to treat the progressive forms of MS. And they were looking mainly at the slow decline over time, the progression of disability in people with progressive MS. And unfortunately, the results were generally negative in terms of it halting the slow decline. There are some elements of that study, like this is preliminary report from that study, so it hasn't been officially out in the medical literature, but that study and some other studies suggest that marijuana could be helpful for the muscle stiffness or spasticity, might be helpful for pain, may be helpful for sleeping difficulties. This is an area that I think you'll see more objective information over the next year or two, especially as medical marijuana laws become more common in the United States. And I think there's information on both of the websites that website names that I gave at the end of the talk. I think it's important to talk with your healthcare provider about this in terms of your specific situation. You know, what do we know about what do the studies actually show in detail? Does that apply to your situation? And then also, there certainly are the safety issues. You know, with smoked marijuana, there certainly can be the potential safety issues with exposure to the smoke, and then other potential side effects to be concerned about. So that needs to be. That all needs to be talked through and weighed into your particular situation. And there's, like I said, the specific websites I gave reference to. And then also if you go to nationalmssociety.org and just put in my name and marijuana. There was an article I wrote about a year and a half ago for Momentum that goes through these studies in detail. There's lots of very detailed information there. And then there's kind of a sidebar. You know, I'm in Colorado. We've had the medical marijuana laws for more than 10 years. Marijuana is now legal here, so I have various anecdotal observations from seeing people use it in our clinic over the past 10 years. So there's a lot of information there.
Our next question comes from Danielle. Danielle, please go ahead.
Yes. My question was answered also with the website. But I do have some questions about certain herbs. There's a small portion that are in some hair vitamins that I have because I don't know exactly what medication over time was causing hair loss. It's starting to come back because there's no hair loss in my family, but I don't know. I know people respond differently to different meds, but just to name a few, I don't know if they're harmful, but if they're not, I will take the hair vitamins. If they are harmful, obviously I'm not going to take them. There is horsetail leaf and parsley leaf and rose hips. I don't know if those are good or bad.
None of those ring bells for me for big red flags of concern, but that's something, those are specific enough. That's something you should talk with your healthcare provider about.
Yeah, I talked to my doctor about it. And he said if, you know, just to look it up online, if it talks about anything about, activating, you know, the immune system.
Immune system?
No. Yeah.
Right.
Okay.
So you can find, I think if you go to the website I mentioned, the Neurology Care website, there may be some information in the detailed chapter on dietary supplements where you can then go to other sources. But yeah, that's very specific. That's hard for me to answer in a program like this.
Our last question comes from Linda. Linda, please go ahead.
My question was about the website too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. That's all.
Our last question comes from Leslie. Leslie, please go ahead.
Hi, Dr. Bowling.
Hi.
Do you consider lecithin a supplement that could have some benefits for MS?
I think it was looked at, 20 or 30 years ago, and there really have not been any studies since then. So I think it's in a, it's just sort of in a gray zone where we don't. I don't know of strong scientific information or animal model studies that would be highly suggestive for it, but I also don't know of any harmful effects specific to MS. So that one needs more study.
Okay, I'd like to thank Dr. Bowling very much for his answers and information this evening. I think it's been very helpful, and unfortunately, we had a lot of questions, Dr. Bowling, and we'd like to thank everyone for tuning in. We will be sending a follow-up email, I believe, in tomorrow's mail for anyone, and we definitely will have that website on there. Dr. Bowling, thank you so much again for joining us this evening. And I believe Dawn, our operator, has a survey for those of you that are on the line. Just three short questions. Good evening.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, at this time, we will begin the polling portion of the call. Please hold while we prepare the questions. Our first question is, after this teleconference, I feel that I have learned more about some of the alternative treatments available to me. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, 4 for not sure. Please hold while we gather the results. Our second question. This teleconference helped me understand some of the risks and benefits to using alternative treatments. Press 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, 4 for not sure. Please hold while we gather the results. Our final question. I have a better understanding of how complementary and alternative medicine can affect my life. 1 for yes, 2 for somewhat, 3 for no, 4 for not sure. Please hold while we gather the results. Ladies and gentlemen, this concludes the polling portion of your call. You may all disconnect.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. Thank you, Dr. Bowling.
Great. Thank you.